West Legal Aid Center would like to welcome you to today's program, The CFTC's Implementation of Financial Market Reform, Progress and Legal Challenges. Thank you for joining our presenter, Dan Berkowitz, a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Wilmer Hale. Please submit questions by clicking the Submit Questions button located directly under your viewer window. The program materials are located to the right of your viewer window. Thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to Dan.
Thank you very much, Alec. Great pleasure to be here talking about the Commodity Futures Trading Commission's implementation of financial market reform. I'm going to talk about the Dodd-Frank Act, Title VII of the Dodd-Frank Act, and the manner in which CFTC has implemented it, as well as review some of the legal challenges that the CFTC has faced in its rulemaking. If you have the presentation, the slide deck I've prepared for this. Briefly, page 2 on the deck outlines what we'll be covering this afternoon now. First, a little bit of background explaining the unregulated swaps market and the financial crisis which led to the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act. Briefly go over the Dodd-Frank Act itself, which covers swaps market reform and a variety of other financial market reforms. Explain in some detail the basic outline of Title VII of Dodd-Frank, which is the swaps regulations provisions, and then go into the CFTC implementation of the Dodd-Frank Act, which has generally been through rulemakings, some guidance, and final orders. And then we'll cover the judicial review of the CFTC rulemakings. I'll go through a bit of the presentation, and if people want to submit questions, be happy to take questions in the later part of the presentation. So let's first start off and talk about unregulated swaps and the financial crisis, the lead-up to and the rationale for the Dodd-Frank Act. Futures markets have been around for a long time. The futures markets were first regulated actually in the 1920s. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission came into force in 1974. Prior to 1974, it had been basically agricultural futures markets that had been regulated. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission Act of 1974 expanded the CFTC's jurisdiction to include all types of futures contracts. That would be agricultural futures. Metals were traded at the time as futures contracts. And increasingly in the 1970s, you had financial futures traded. These were all within the CFTC's jurisdiction. The swaps market began to develop in the 1980s as a means where there weren't necessarily futures contracts to cover the risks, such as interest rate changes in interest rates, and parties were entering into bilateral transactions in order to protect themselves against fluctuations in interest rates and in currency rates. The question then arose, what's the difference between a swap and a future? They both exchange, both swaps and futures exchange a value and expose the parties to the risk and the change of an underlying commodity or economic something of economic value, such as a rate. As the swaps market developed, there was the question, what really is the difference between a swap and a future? And this has tremendous significance for the parties because under the Commodity Exchange Act, all futures contracts have to be traded on regulated futures exchanges. So anything that's not, any futures contract that is not traded on a regulated exchange would be determined to be illegal. Parties that had entered into swaps were concerned partially that the government, the CFTC, might come in and say, this is an illegal futures contract and you should have traded on an exchange and take enforcement action. But actually, the greater concern at the time was that the losing party to the transaction would say, this deal is null and void, I don't have to pay up because it was an illegal futures contract. As a result of this legal uncertainty, throughout the 1980s and 1990s, the CFTC issued a number of policy statements and actually regulatory exemptions exempting various types of swaps from CFTC regulation and the exchange trading requirement. The policy statements issued by the CFTC, the regulations issued by the CFTC exempting the transactions from the swap transactions from the exchange traded requirement, didn't fully provide the legal certainty that many parties were looking for. It provided some assurance that the CFTC would not take enforcement action, but as I mentioned earlier, it didn't provide assurance that the losing party or party that didn't want to pay up on the losing end of a swap transaction would seek to have the contract voided and not pay. As a result of the legal uncertainty, in 2000, Congress finally determined to provide legal certainty to the swaps market and provided that swaps bilaterally negotiated between eligible contract participants, meaning participants who have certain net assets or net worth, were excluded, who entered into these swaps, were excluded from CFTC jurisdiction under the Commodity Exchange Act. CFMA also excluded energy swaps and certain other types of swaps that were traded on a trading facility. So the bilateral transactions, as well as certain types of energy swaps and other what's referred to as excluded commodity swaps traded on a trading facility, an exchange, were also excluded. CFTC, therefore, had no jurisdiction over the swaps market by statute beginning in 2000. Throughout the 2000s, first part of the decade, the CFMA really was took hold, and it was a new statute, and there wasn't too much questioning about it. But as the decade went on, we had Enron, we had the hedge fund Amaranth collapse, and we had the Western power crisis with market manipulation of electricity prices in the over-the-counter bilateral markets out west on the electricity commodity transactions. And we had also skyrocketing oil prices throughout those years. And that led to a number of people questioning really whether these energy markets, for example, energy swaps, really should be fully deregulated or not. That controversy really simmered along through the mid-2000s, but what really changed everything was the financial crisis in 2008. Now, there were many causes of the crisis, the financial crisis. Slide 5 in the presentation lists a number of the causes identified in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Report, which is the commission set up by Congress to look into the causes. And the FCIC's report reflects many of the causes that I think most people would agree on. There's all sorts of causes to the financial crisis in 2008. One can talk about balance of payments internationally, low interest rates, foreign investors looking, the best place to make investments during those years was U.S. markets, U.S. real estate market, real estate bubble, all sorts of causes to the crisis. And certainly by no means was the lack of regulation in the over-the-counter derivatives, or which is another name for swaps, swaps market certainly was not the only crisis, but it was widely attributed to be one of the principal causes of the financial crisis. There was no regulation of these markets. There was little transparency in these markets. And the lack of transparency, the lack of regulation, the lack of any ability to for the regulators to control the risks, to see the risks, to limit the risks that people were taking, was totally absent. So that was one of the key causes to the report. The report found that was one of the key causes to the crisis. As a result, both nationally and internationally, there was a broad consensus that these markets could no longer be subject to little or no regulation. Page 6 reflects the agreement and the commitment of the G20 leaders to, among other things, strengthen the regulation of derivatives. The G20 leaders were meeting often during this time, 2006 2007-2008, a number of meetings as the financial crisis was at its peak and afterwards in order to take measures to ensure that such a broad wide-scale crisis would not happen again and threaten the global economy. So at Pittsburgh was the culmination of a number of efforts by the number of meetings and discussions by the G20 to move forward with action to prevent a future crisis. So with respect to the regulation of the financial markets, there's other things the G20 addressed, but we're focusing here on the regulation of the financial markets, and in particular, over-the-counter derivatives. And I'm using the term over-the-counter derivatives and swaps interchangeably. Over-the-counter is just an informal term, meaning not traded on an exchange. And so what was not traded on an exchange? Well, basically swaps. Swaps were finally defined in the Dodd-Frank Act. They didn't have a formal definition prior to that, but I'm using those terms interchangeably. So the G20 commitment at Pittsburgh was both for international harmonization and specific measures to improve the over-counter derivatives markets. So it was recognized that no individual country can do this alone. The swaps market are truly global in nature. These transactions cross boundaries. The institutions that undertake them are in many jurisdictions with many, many affiliates, and as we'll see a little later, that presents its own challenges in terms of who should regulate these multinational institutions and how to determine who has jurisdiction over certain transactions. But the G20 leaders recognized the need for both international harmonization and certain specific actions. So the G20 leaders stated, "We are committed to take action at the national and international level to raise standards together so that our national authorities implement global standards consistently in a way that ensures a level playing field and avoids fragmentation of markets, protectionism, and regulatory arbitrage." Those are truly unobjectionable and goals that I think everybody would agree on. And in the years since then, the international regulators and the market participants have all been supportive of these goals. Progress has been made, but there's a lot to be done, as you can imagine, on something that involves so many nations. Specifically with respect to the swaps markets, the derivatives markets, the G20 commitment was the following. All standardized OTC derivative contracts should be traded on exchanges or electronic trading platforms where appropriate and cleared through central counterparties by end 2012 at the latest. This was 2009, so that was a 3-year deadline. OTC derivative contracts should be reported to trade repositories. Non-centrally cleared contracts should be subject to higher capital requirements. So basically, you have the key takeaways here from the G20 are standardized contracts cleared and traded on exchanges or electronic trading platforms, cleared through central counterparties by 2012, and reporting. And that fundamental framework, turning to slide 7, that fundamental framework is essentially what the administration proposed in its regulatory reform proposal at about the same time as those G20 commitments were made. The administration actually sent up its financial reform package in outline form and textual form in May of 2009, followed by specific legislative language to the Congress in August of 2009. And the administration was developing its legislative proposal for regulatory reform at the same time it was participating in the G20 discussions about what should be done and what the internationally and the international agreement. So they are consistent, and they were rolled out at approximately the same time. One of the key components of the administration's proposal on regulatory reform was here again, the establishing comprehensive regulation of financial markets. Other key objectives, which certainly are as prominent and read about in the paper daily. Robust supervision and regulation of financial firms, protect consumers and investors from financial abuse, provide the government the tools it needs to manage financial crises, and that really is referring to resolution authority. So you can go in, you don't have to wait for a bankruptcy such as happened in the Lehman Brothers. You can take a firm that is about to fail and transfer its assets or take other measures to stabilize the firm. You don't have a binary choice of let it fail and go into bankruptcy or don't let it fail, and in which case you can't do anything. So that was another key component of the reform package, and again, raise international regulatory standards and improve international cooperation. The danger, of course, being if one country imposes higher standards and others do not, then market participants may just transfer their activities to the lesser regulated jurisdictions. In what certainly now seems like lightning speed for Congress, and I think by any measure, it was a very speedy legislative process. As I mentioned, the administration submitted its legislative proposals to the Congress in August of 2009, and turning to slide 9, we see that the Dodd-Frank Act was passed by the Congress and actually signed into law by the President on July 21st, 2010. So in less than a year, the Congress enacted major legislation to reform the financial markets. Of course, at the time, we had the White House and both houses of Congress controlled by the same party, which makes legislating a lot easier than when you have divided government. So Dodd-Frank Act had 16 titles, covered a variety of reforms for financial market regulation, dealt with systemic risk, dealt with banks and capital requirements for banks, dealt with what I was talking about earlier, resolution authority, so that you don't have to wait to bankruptcy for take action against a major firm, regulated hedge fund advisors, enhanced investor protection, consumer protection, mortgage reform. And what we're going to focus on here, Title VII of the Dodd-Frank Act, which is the regulation of the swaps market. So let's go into the key components of Dodd-Frank in terms of the regulation of the swaps market. We saw in the financial crisis that the swaps market, contrary to what was initially thought, and this is one of the reasons why supporting the deregulation of the swaps markets in the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, and you'll still see this talked about and written about to a certain extent, but derivatives, and they do perform this function still, derivatives were thought uniformly to be risk dispersing, that credit default swaps would enable a party in a transaction with the counterparty. There's two types of risk. There's the risk of whatever if you do an oil swap with somebody, there's the risk that the oil price is going to move against you, but there's also the risk that your counterparty might go bankrupt or might be unable to pay before when payment is due. So you're subject to both market risk and credit risk. Credit default swaps were thought as a great way to reduce your credit risk in that transaction. So if you have a transaction with a counterparty on oil prices, an oil swap, and then you do a credit default swap with somebody else, you would only be exposed to the price of oil. You wouldn't be exposed to the credit of the counterparty. So initially, derivatives, credit default swaps were thought a great way to diversify risk, to spread risk, and that would lessen risk in the system because the people that would be assuming risk would be the ones that would be best able to bear it. As we saw, that model really didn't work in the financial crisis, that the derivatives essentially interconnected everybody. So it really perhaps isn't so much too big to fail as too interconnected to fail is what we saw. So one of the key objectives of the swaps regulation is to reduce the systemic risk that is presented by all these swap transactions, because the failure of one party lead to a failure of another party, lead to a failure of another party, and you have a whole cascade of counterparties failing, and concerns about the failure of the counterparty leads to runs on banks and large financial institutions. So reduction of systemic risk posed by these instruments is a key objective of the legislation. So how is this accomplished? Well, regulation of the market participants themselves and regulation of the markets, increasing the transparency of the transactions and of the swaps market. One of the problems in the crisis is there was no reporting of swaps. Nobody had any window into who held what position. So the government comes in and tries to fashion a solution, or other companies come in and you're thinking about buying the assets or assuming the transactions of some other company. And you got to have some transparency into what they're doing and what their book is to be able to do that. You read all these stories about people coming in weekends before the crisis and spending 48 consecutive hours or 72 hours trying to figure out what the transactions of a company were. Different companies have different accounting systems. Became mini crises in themselves. So transparency, increasing transparency into the derivative markets, in getting a handle on who has what positions was considered critical to reducing systemic risk and to either enable in a crisis market participants or the government to be able to transfer some of these risks or positions to other parties that could bear them. Speculative position limits, limiting the size of positions that market participants had. Enhanced enforcement capabilities. Speaking in this context here, it's the CFTC, but obviously it's broader than that in the whole context of all Dodd-Frank. And cross-border application is recognized that the swaps market is truly global, that transactions between persons in different jurisdictions, a significant portion of the market, and therefore the legislation would need to have cross-border application to be really effective. As equally important as those objectives are in terms of controlling risks and reducing risks, increasing transparency, was to preserve the ability of the commercial entities and users to hedge their commercial risks. After all, the futures markets, the central purpose of the futures markets is to enable commercial entities to hedge, to manage their risk, to reduce their risk. That's the essential point why we have a futures market to begin with, and really a key function of the swaps market as well. It's for the real economy. The market doesn't exist just for the sake of existing and to support traders, but the point of it is to enable commercial businesses to better manage their risks. And so throughout the legislation, there are provisions addressed to ensuring that the new requirements don't impose unnecessary burdens on commercial end users. And we'll see that in a few concrete examples. I've been talking about swaps, and I'm going to, throughout the rest of the time, talk about swaps. In so doing, I'm technically being accurate in including what's called security-based swaps, but rather than speak the mouthful swaps and security-based swaps all the time, I'm just going to refer to swaps. But it's significantly from a jurisdictional perspective, Dodd-Frank really mirrored the pre-crisis jurisdictional split between the CFTC and the Securities and Exchange Commission. CFTC regulated futures and options on futures, and the SEC regulated securities, and we have all sorts of new instruments. There's a question of which is what. There have been jurisdictional issues over the years. Dodd-Frank really kept the line, but extended into swaps. So CFTC regulates swaps, commodity swaps, such as oil swaps, energy, electricity swaps, FX, foreign currency swaps, interest rate swaps, and broad-based security indexes. There's a definition in the statute, basically nine or more securities. It's called a broad-based, in an index, it's called a broad-based index. SEC regulates security-based swaps, single-name securities, credit default swaps, single-name credit default swaps, or a narrow base, which is nine or fewer. And the subtitle A of Title VII is CFTC regulation of swaps. Subtitle B is SEC regulation of security-based swaps, and they're very, very similar. In many respects, they're identical. There are some significant differences. Security-based swaps are securities, and they fall under the SEC's regime. CFTC, the swaps are not securities. They're under the CFTC's regime. The agencies are directed to consult and coordinate on a couple of rulemakings, which we'll talk about. There are joint rulemakings, but each of them has separate legislative mandates to implement their respective subtitles of Title VII. So I'm going to be just talking about the CFTC, although much of what I said in terms of Dodd-Frank, the Dodd-Frank overall framework applies to the SEC side, security-based side as well. The CFTC has finalized more regulations on the regulation of derivatives than the SEC has at this point. So the actual implementation is farther along on the CFTC side than the SEC side. Talk about slide 12, the regulation of market participants. Again, the fundamental goal here is the reduction of risks presented by swap dealers. Swap dealers are firms that, as the name implies, deal in swaps. If you are an institution, again, individuals can't really do swaps unless they're very wealthy, meet the eligible contract participant definition. And you want to do a swap, you go to a swap dealer, and you can find other counterparties, but swap dealers make a market in swaps. That's their business, is doing swaps with counterparties. So the objective of the regulation of market participants is reduce risk presented by swap dealers and other firms with a large swap business. Some firms, as we saw in the crisis, developed a huge swap business even though they weren't really dealers. The best example of this is AIG, which sold a lot of credit default swaps on these mortgage-backed instruments, and it wasn't doing it to deal per se. It wasn't making markets in them, but it just amassed a huge book, and they would be, under the legislation, classified as a major swap participant. So if you're a dealer or an MSP, I'm going to just refer to dealers here, although the same rules apply to MSPs, again, so I don't have to say so many words. But the dealers are required to register with the CFTC. There's capital and margin requirements if you're a swap dealer. You have to have a certain amount of capital so that you have a cushion to absorb losses. If you're a bank swap dealer, the capital is determined by the Federal Reserve or the appropriate prudential regulator, could be one of the other bank regulators, and as well as the margin requirements on your transaction. If you're a non-bank swap dealer, and that would be like an energy company, for example, BP is registered as a swap dealer, your capital and margin requirements would be established by the CFTC, and they're supposed to consult with the bank regulators in terms of margin requirements. For these market participants, there's business conduct standards. So what I referred to earlier, which was so absent in the 2000s leading up to the crisis, risk management programs, record keeping for all your transactions, reporting to central repository of swaps, back office requirements. This is documentation and reconciliation. Portfolio compression, basically so that your book is, you know all your transactions, which offset the other ones, you know your total exposure on a real-time basis. There's market conduct standards and disclosure standards for your counterparties. As a swap dealer, you would agree with your counterparty on how to value the swap, what to do if there's a dispute about the valuation of the swap, and there's heightened standards for swap dealers dealing with special entities Special entities are things like state and local governments. They'd be a school district, a pension funds. You may have read some of the horror stories about school districts that enter into swaps, you know, think they're getting a great deal and lowering their interest rate payments, and then something happens and these payments balloon and the schools can't afford textbooks because they got to pay some Wall Street bank. So there's additional business conduct standards for these transactions with special entities. And that's on the regulation of market participants on the dealer side. Moving to slide 13, talk about briefly the regulation of markets. Again, the objective is to reduce the systemic risks of these transactions to provide a greater transparency to the market. How is that accomplished? Well, central here is the clearing mandate for what I've labeled here as standardized swaps. Now, these essentially are standardized swaps, but the legislation does not actually use that term standardized. When the administration sent up its proposal, initially it talked about clearing for standardized swaps, but then the actual definition of standardized became a little difficult. The legislation specifies a number of factors that should be considered and whether the CFTC should require a swap to be cleared, what's the liquidity in the swap, how big is the market for the swap, truly are the terms standardized, are they the same terms commonly used? And for these swaps that meet these factors, essentially making it a standardized swap, the CFTC makes a determination whether there's sufficient liquidity and standardization that the swap should be required to be cleared. If the CFTC determines the swap should be cleared, then all market participants, sorry for the siren in the background, all the market participants, unless there's an exception, are required to clear the swap. And the major exception in the legislation is for what's called the end-user exception. This is non-financial end-users that enter into swaps to hedge or mitigate commercial risk are accepted from the clearing requirement. And here is what I was talking about before. The purpose of the legislation is really to enable end-users, fundamental purpose of the markets exists for end-users to be able to hedge or mitigate risk. So if you have the best example would be a company seeking to explore and produce natural gas. The clearing requirement, if you require them to clear their derivatives and swaps, that will cause them to take money that otherwise would be used for exploration and development and stick it in a clearinghouse where it sits in an account, doesn't get any interest for the gas exploration company. And if you look at the sources of systemic risk and where the major sources of risk were in terms of market participants either prior to the crisis or post-crisis, it really wasn't in the commercial sector of the economy. These types of swaps, these end-user swaps, represent about 6% of the entire market. The dealers and the large financial institutions are well over 90% of the swaps market. So doing a roughly, a economic cost benefit as well as a political cost benefit, there's most of the risk reduction, the vast majority of the risk reduction can be achieved and is achieved by applying the clearing requirement to the financial counterparties, not also including the commercial end users. So there's a commercial end user exception. For swaps that are required to be cleared, there's also the execution mandate. Swaps required to be cleared must be traded on or through a regulated exchange or swap execution facility unless no exchange or SEF, there's another acronym, swap execution facility, which is a special facility defined in the legislation for the trading of swaps, unless no exchange or SEF makes the swap available to trade. So if you have to clear it, you have to trade it on an exchange or a SEF unless there's no exchange or SEF that trades it. There's transparency requirements. All swaps have to be reported to a swap data repository. If there's no swap data repository for the swap, then it gets reported to the commission, but we have swap data repositories now where all the swaps can be reported. There's real-time public reporting for swaps, which means the legislation defines as soon as technologically practicable. Real-time public reporting would not include the name of the parties. It preserves the anonymity, but it's sort of like the ticker tape that you would see years ago on the New York Stock Exchange. You'd see the type of swap, you know, oil swap, you'd see the price, and you'd see the volume. And so people can look on the screen and get some idea of what the price of that swap is in the market rather than have to go shop around to dealers and be reliant on others for the price of swaps. And there's margin requirements for uncleared swaps. Turning to page 14, I've talked about some of these infrastructures already. Number of these infrastructures were in existence prior to Dodd-Frank. Derivative clearing organizations were actually set up in the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, as well as designated contract markets, which is the fancy term for futures exchanges. And foreign boards of trade, which is an exchange in another country, basically. Of course, those were existed prior to Dodd-Frank. But Dodd-Frank enhanced and strengthened what's called the core principles of these infrastructures. Additional core principles, more prescriptive core principles and regulations under Commodity Futures Modernization Act. It was a principles-based approach. Dodd-Frank gave the CFTC the authority to be prescriptive in how the core principles should be implemented. In some instances, the CFTC has retained the principles-based approach. With respect to other issues, it's been much more prescriptive. On the derivative clearing organization, it's actually a Title VIII issue in Dodd-Frank, but there's heightened standards for derivative clearing organizations that are determined to be systemically important. The determination of systemically important is made by the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and it has been made for three DCOs. Once that determination is made, they are the DCO subject to these enhanced standards, which were established by the CFTC in a rulemaking last year. This is a recognition that when all swaps we have a clearing requirement, and many more swaps are going to be cleared through these clearing organizations, that these clearing organizations themselves become more systemically important. So these standards have been tightened. There's been international agreement on the standards for these systemically important derivative clearing organizations. So this is actually an area in terms of the international standards for clearing organizations. This is an example of a successful area where there's an agreement on international standards and the various countries like the U.S. are implementing them. Whether the countries recognize what other countries do as meeting the requisite standards is a separate issue, but there was basic agreement on what these standards should be for these important DCOs. Swap execution facilities are new, newly created by the legislation, are the swap data repositories where the data gets reported. But they're all subject to registration with the CFTC, core principles, which are set forth in the statute, and then specific principles of what those requirements under those core principles are established by CFTC. You can trade a swap on a designated contract market on a futures exchange if the futures exchange lists the swap for trading, or you can trade it on a CEF. Foreign boards of trade, the legislation provides that any foreign board of trade that provides direct access to persons in the U.S. has to be registered with the CFTC as well. Slide 15, critical component of the CFTC's authority under Dodd-Frank is its new enforcement authority. It was provided with an additional anti-manipulation standard based upon the Securities Exchange Act 10B standard, which is fraud-based anti-manipulation authority, prevents use of any manipulative, deceptive device or contrivance. And this is in addition to the basic anti-manipulation authority that's been in the Commodity Exchange Act. The concern here, what led to this really was the concern that the CFTC standard in the Commodity Exchange Act had been developed to prevent corners and squeezes in the futures market and was too difficult. The burden of proof under that standard, which developed through the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, was too high a bar on the CFTC. With one case of successful prosecution for manipulation of the CEA in the last 30 years. And now whether that's a right or wrong perception and can be debated as to why there was only one case, that's a whole separate debate. But nonetheless, it resulted in Congress providing the CFTC with this additional anti-manipulation authority based upon the SEC standard, which Congress had also previously provided to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission with respect to electricity and natural gas markets in its jurisdiction, and to the Federal Trade Commission with respect to the commodity markets in its jurisdiction, which is basically retail gasoline, for example. So there's the new anti-manipulation authority. There's also new authority to prohibit what term disruptive trading practices. These are may or may not rise to the level of manipulation, but it's ways that traders have traditionally traded to achieve a result that's considered sometimes considered manipulative. If you don't take the best bidder offer, if you don't trade in an orderly manner, and if you send in false signals into the market, spoofing to give a false sense of market direction or liquidity. There's whistleblower authorities and a whistleblower fund, which right now there's about, I think it's around $250 million in the CFTC's whistleblower fund, that if you, if a whistleblower provides information that leads to recovery, a successful prosecution and recovery of a judgment, the whistleblower can get up to, I believe it's 30% of that judgment. Then there's the provision, which is a very fun provision I had the pleasure of working on, called the Eddie Murphy provision. If any of you have seen the movie Trading Places, Eddie Murphy starred in Trading Places, and they were Trading Places concerned a scheme by the Duke brothers to corner or squeeze, no pun intended, the frozen concentrated orange juice market. And they were going to do this because they stole the government's crop information about the orange juice crop. But little did the Duke brothers know that Eddie Murphy had stolen it first, and they actually had the false crop information. And so Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd bankrupted the Duke brothers. And I go through that not just because it's a great movie, but at the time, if you stealing of the crop information and using that to trade was not illegal. What the scheme in Trading Places was not that the stealing of that government information and trading on it was not illegal. Manipulating the market was illegal, but the stealing of the information was not. So the Eddie Murphy provision in Dodd-Frank prohibits the use of non-public government information prior to its official release. So what Eddie Murphy, he couldn't do what he did without violating law. Slide 16, another key thing is limits on speculative positions. The legislation directed, and this whole issue about to what extent it directed, as I'll explain in a minute about the law, involves a lawsuit as to whether this rulemaking was mandatory, but the Dodd-Frank Act directed the CFTC to set position limits for swaps as well as futures contracts for energy, metals, and agricultural commodities. Prior to Dodd-Frank, there were limits on speculative positions on the futures exchanges, and the limits, expanding the limits to include swaps was part of the Dodd-Frank legislation. The CFTC's initial rule on this that was promulgated in November of 2011 was vacated by the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, and last fall, the CFTC reproposed the rule. We'll talk about that lawsuit in just a minute. A key provision is the cross-border provision. As I mentioned, many swaps are cross-border, and the cross-border provision is Section 2I, which says provisions of the CEA relating to swaps shall not apply to activities outside the U.S. unless those activities, okay, double negative here, so the tests here are when it does apply, have a direct and significant connection with activities in or effect on commerce of the United States, or contravene such rules or regulations as the Commission may prescribe or promulgate as are necessary or appropriate to prevent the evasion of any provision of the CEA. So the question is what is a direct and significant, which activities have a direct and significant connection with activities in or effect on commerce of the United States? CFTC implementation of Dodd-Frank. Remember, the goal was to have clearing in place. The G20 goal was to have clearing in place by the end of 2012. CFTC almost made it. Clearing started in the end of March, early April 2013. Only missed it by about 4 months. CFTC did 65 final rules, orders, and guidance documents since the passage of Dodd-Frank, and that was from 2010 through 2013, so it's like 3.5 years. It's a lot of rulemaking in a short amount of time. We have 102 swap dealers provisionally registered with the CFTC. Registration began in December 2012. There's a mandatory clearing requirement in place for interest rate and index credit default swaps. Again, there's the end-user exception to that clearing requirement. We have 22 swap execution facilities temporarily registered, and along with the mandatory clearing requirement, there's mandatory trading for CEFs or exchanges for certain of those interest rate index CDSs. Not all the ones that are cleared have been made available to trade on a facility. Only some of them. So it's not a one-to-one between what's cleared and what has to be traded, but everything that has to be traded, obviously, on the trading facility is already subject to the clearing requirement. There's 4 swap data repositories, and reporting of swaps is well underway. If you look at the CFTC website, you can see there's about, under the swaps reporting page on their website, there's about $400 trillion in swaps notional value that's reported. CFTC has promulgated rules to implement its new anti-manipulation authority, and it's provided guidance on cross-border activities. So I'm going to briefly talk about some of the details in the rules, although I've actually covered a lot of this information in describing the legislative provisions. Swap dealer, to be a swap dealer, you are a swap dealer if you enter into, in the course of the previous 12 months, $8 billion in notional value in swaps through your swap dealing activities. You have to be engaged in dealing activities, but if you're engaged in dealing and you hit this $8 billion threshold, then you have to register as a dealer. Is $8 billion a lot? If you're a large bank, if you're Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or somebody like that, they hit that $8 billion threshold in the matter of a few days. But those are the largest ones. We have 102, as I mentioned, globally. Others, if you don't hit the $8 billion threshold, general swaps or $25 million with special entity counterparties, then you're not required to register as a swap dealer. We have, oh, I think there's only one or two major swap participants, and the exposure levels, what your outstanding exposure has to be for MSP is a little more complicated. Don't have time to go into the actual details right now. And registration began in December 2012 for these swap dealers. The CFTC has implemented the business conduct standards that I mentioned before. There's rules specifying exactly counterparty verification, disclosure, documentation, know your customer, disclosure of risks, disclosure of valuation, arbitration, dispute resolution, all that. There's regulations on all that. There's internal, what we call internal business conduct standards. The dealers have to have risk management programs. They have to have portfolio compression and reconciliation, chief compliance officer, record keeping, monitoring. They have to supervise their employees and avoid certain conflicts of interest. Page 21, the clearing requirement, which I think I've covered pretty much on slide 21 in terms of the CFTC's regulations paralleling the statutory provisions, although in significantly more detail. There's also some additional exceptions to the clearing requirement that the CFTC has implemented. The inter-affiliate exception, two affiliates of the same company don't have to clear. A cooperative exception, this would be farm co-ops or electricity co-ops. The swaps between members those co-ops don't have to clear. The treasury exception is not many companies, the commercial companies, will have what they call a treasury affiliate. And the treasury affiliate is established as the outward-facing entity for all the internal affiliates to who will face the market. And if the only purpose of this treasury affiliate of a non-financial company is to face outwards, then the treasury affiliate may be able to take advantage of the end user exception if it's hedging or mitigating risk on behalf of the company, just as it, because it's really part of the end user itself. It's not a separate financial entity. Also, small financial institutions, small banks, savings associations, credit unions, farm credit institutions with assets less than $10 billion. The small bank exception, which is provided for in statute, CFTC has implemented. Trade execution requirement, slide 22. What I would add here to what I've already talked about is the SEFs themselves. There's the CFTC regulations. If your swap has to be traded on a SEF, if it's subject to the trade execution requirement, the second bullet here, slide 22, is the operative one. The trade execution must be by order book or request for quote to a minimum number of market participants. It has to be made available. The SEF has to provide the capability for people to make a bid or offer the entire market. Any facility that permits multiple participants to execute or trade swaps by accepting bids or offers made by multiple participants must register as a SEF. So the SEF is really a multiple-to-multiple facility. If you have to trade on a SEF because you're subject to trade execution, the SEF has to give you the capability for going out to multiple to parties. Similarly, if you're an entity that provides the capability of multiple-to-multiple trading, you have to register as a SEF. If it doesn't have to be traded on a SEF, then the SEF can have other methods of execution. It doesn't have to use the multiple-to-multiple methods of execution for what are called permitted transactions rather than mandatory transactions, which have to be traded on a SEF. Slide 23, I've mentioned the reporting and record-keeping requirements. Virtually all swaps have to be reported to the swap data repository. They have unique swap identifiers. They have unique legal entity identifiers. There's creation data, which is specified in the regulations when the swap is executed, and continuation data that gets talks about what happens over the event of a swap, if it's terminated, if it's novated. Other types of events specified in the regulations also have to be reported, so you just don't have stale information in the SDR. You sort of know when things have changed. And then real-time reporting. There's also record keeping for everybody. The CFTC, and one of the more areas that's been more controversial, is the cross-border guidance. This was issued in July 2013. It specifies under what circumstances and how CFTC regulations apply to activities that cross borders, maybe persons from outside the United States transacting with persons in the United States, persons outside the United States transacting with affiliates of persons who are outside the United States or branches. So the guidance defines a U.S. person. U.S. person concept is critical for determining when Dodd-Frank applies. It generally applies to transactions with U.S. persons. So if you look and see, aha, there's a U.S. person there on the other side of my transaction, Dodd-Frank applies. The guidance tells you what the U.S. person is. It deals with the question of foreign branches and affiliates, even though they may not be may or may not be U.S. persons. In the case of affiliates, they still may be subject to Dodd-Frank, depending on their relationship with the parent. What counts in terms of determining whether you're a dealer, if you're a non-U.S. person, if you're a bank in France doing swaps, you, for example, count all your swaps with U.S. persons in determining whether you're a swap dealer. So if you do some swaps with banks and people in France and some swaps with people in the U.S., you only count the swaps you do with U.S. persons to whether you hit that $8 billion threshold. But once you're a dealer, you're a dealer. If you hit that $8 billion threshold in U.S. persons, you're a dealer for everything. But then the guidance says, okay, well, what are your non-U.S. activities? How much of our regulations will apply when you're dealing with non-U.S. persons? And the guidance addresses that. Those are called the types of requirements that the CFTC promulgated. The CFTC divides them up, categorizes them into entity level and transaction level requirements. And so, for example, on entity level requirements, that French bank, if it's a U.S. swap dealer because of its transactions with U.S. persons, all its entity level requirements would be have to follow Dodd-Frank, but some of its transactions with non-U.S. persons, it wouldn't have to follow Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank would not apply to a transaction between a French bank and a French auto company, for example. And the concept of substitute compliance says even if Dodd-Frank applies to a non-U.S. entity or a transaction occurring outside the U.S., under various circumstances, we will consider compliance with the host country requirements to satisfy Dodd-Frank. The CFTC has issued a number of these substitute compliance determinations. It's almost one, so I'm just going to go through some of this these other things pretty quickly here. Rulemaking is not yet completed. Capital requirements for the non-bank swap dealers and major swap participants and the margin for uncleared swaps. Position limits rule is still outstanding. That was re-proposed after the U.S. District Court vacated the initial rule. And the CFTC has proposed to raise the de minimis standard for utility special entities. These are like municipal utilities because there weren't enough counterparties at the low de minimis level, so they've proposed to increase that to the general de minimis level. I'm just going to briefly go over the judicial challenges here in the next couple minutes. Most of the CFTC regulations have gone into effect without judicial challenge. The only regulation that's been invalidated has been the position limits rule. The other decisions have generally followed traditional administrative law principles and statutory interpretation principles. Deference to the agency and things within its expertise. You get deference on statutory interpretation where the statute is ambiguous, but if it's not, you don't. There was a concern that the D.C. Circuit, based upon what it had done, decisions with a number of SEC cases a number of years earlier, was going to apply heightened standard, especially with respect to the cost-benefit, and that the CFTC regulations, like the SEC regulations of a few years earlier, would be knocked down because the courts would be taking a very, very high standard of judicial review as applied to the cost-benefit. We just haven't seen that yet. The one circuit court case and the CFTC that went to the D.C. Circuit, and CFTC decisions initially go to the D.C. District Court, but the one that made it both to the District Court and was decided in the Court of Appeals was Investment Company Institute, ICI versus CFTC, and that decision really followed traditional agency deference, and it upheld the rule, found that the cost-benefit requirement did not require a quantitative analysis. The CFTC wasn't required to quantify the unquantifiable. Very deferential standard to the CFTC rulemaking in the ICI decision in the D.C. Circuit. So that was a significant decision for the CFTC and its rulemaking. Mentioned the position limits rule, which was overturned on basically an issue of statutory interpretation. The district court disagreed with the CFTC's reading of the statute. The CFTC thought it was unambiguous that it had to do a rulemaking. The court held it was ambiguous, and therefore the CFTC was entitled to no deference and vacated the rule, ordered the agency to go back and explain why it didn't have to make predicate findings on necessity before it issued a position limits rule. Bloomberg versus CFTC was decided on standing. Standing quest issue that the plaintiff hadn't proved actual harm, didn't really get to the merits of the reg. The big issue right now, the pending case is SIFMA versus CFTC, whether CFTC's guidance is an improper rule or not, that the plaintiffs are claiming that CFTC really should have done a rule on cross-border issues rather than interpretive guidance. It didn't follow the APA, it didn't do a cost-benefit, and that none of the rules should have any extraterritorial application because the CFTC did not do cost-benefit on its extraterritorial application, and the guidance didn't either. The CFTC says the guidance is not binding, it's not a rule, therefore it doesn't have to go through rulemaking. We've always said it was not binding, is what the CFTC says. Furthermore, the rules have extraterritorial application not because of the CFTC rulemaking process, but because of the operation of the statute in 2I, and all the CFTC has really done is provide guidance on 2I, and that perfectly permissible route under the Administrative Procedure Act. So that's the big outstanding case. Parties have submitted briefs. Oral argument has not been scheduled this summer yet, so I don't know if it'll be oral argument in the fall or what, but that's in the U.S. District Court here in the District of Columbia. So that's a quick run-through of causes of financial crisis, Dodd-Frank, CFTC's implementation, which, as I mentioned, is well underway. Has been some judicial challenges, but to date, only one rule has been overturned. A cross-border challenge is a much more broad challenge. We'll see how that goes and see whether what the court does there. So at this point, this is where we are. So I'd just like to thank you all for this opportunity to present. And with that, I will sign off. So thank you very much.
Thank you for selecting West Legal Ed Center. For optimal savings, why not consider a customized subscription? you'll get unlimited access to the largest, most current CLE library offered online. Call 1-866-765-MCLE for more information on how to maximize this opportunity. That's 1-866-765-MCLE for continuing education that's always comprehensive, always relevant, always current.